Hello, Will.
Hey, Rohan, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. And it's not just you I need to say hello to today.
Absolutely.
Podcast first.
Yeah, Two Blues exclusive first for us is we have a guest joining us.
Hello, Amber. Everyone. My name's Amber. I'm a final year medical student at the moment at the University of Birmingham. Thank you very much, you two, for inviting me on the podcast.
My pleasure. It's very opportune timing because I think we had a topic that we wanted to talk about. And we thought, actually, obviously Rohan will know quite a lot about this, but I know nothing at all. So we need someone else to be able to respond to whatever Rohan is saying with at least something sensible. So Rohan, do you want to talk about what we're going to be discussing today?
Yeah, so I thought it'd be quite an interesting insight into what essentially we should talk about medicine and doctors. And the fact that there seems to be a big exodus amongst particularly junior doctors leaving the NHS. So I found some stats for this, which kind of might put things into context. So in the early 2000s, once junior doctors finished their basic training, so when you finish medical school, you do something called foundation year one and two. And when doctors in 2000s were finishing their medical training, 80% of them would then go on and apply to further training, like specialty training or apply to become GPs, for example. That percentage, I think it was 2015, it dropped to 20%. So essentially, there's a huge decline in the number of doctors actually taking further training. I mean, some will come back, but a lot of them leave to go, as I did, to Australia. Others will leave entirely. So I thought it'd be quite interesting to kind of discuss what the main motivators are behind that today.
So hold on. So 20% of all the people who qualify as doctors will only be a doctor for 2 years, basically, in the UK, in the NHS.
I think it's the same article. And I thought it was difficult to tell whether those doctors who were not applying to specialty training programs after their F1 and F2 were simply waiting a couple of years to apply to specialty training and had therefore kind of fallen out of the statistic, or whether they were going away altogether to work for a different healthcare system or leaving medicine altogether. So there's different populations and imagine different motivations for doing each one. But nevertheless, like, it is pretty shocking how much there's been a trend change in what people do after that initial training period.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely that we're losing 80% of doctors at the end of two.
Yeah.
I know people moan first.
Yeah, you'd have to have so many medical students to make that even slightly sustainable.
But I suppose the thing is, before people... You know, obviously now we have something called Foundation Year 1 and 2, or F1, F2 for short. But it's fashionable to essentially do an F3 or sometimes even an F4. Mm. Whereas before, they were almost frowned upon, almost like a gap year, I suppose. Like, it just wasn't a thing that people did. Whereas now it's almost expected that you end up doing that.
So in my limited understanding, I thought that if you wanted to do surgery, you did an F3. Is that right? Or is that wrong?
I think doing an F3 isn't necessarily specific to a particular training program, as from my understanding. But there can be a lot of benefits to doing one rather than just waiting to get onto a training program, in that you have more time to enrich your CV and get experience in a particular area that you might not have had a chance to get an experience in during your F1 and F2, and just generally strengthen your application if you're interested in a particular training program. Especially because a lot of training programs, as I understand it, are getting more competitive. They have higher, you know, levels of requirements from an academic perspective, from an experience perspective. Like, waiting longer to do a specialty training application can, like, have kind of certain benefits for your own application.
Hmm. Okay. So I guess those are the statistics. But was that, so Rohan, in your cohort, is that what you saw? Did you see a lot of people dropping out in foundation, doing something else? What happened?
I think in my cohort, most people carried, well, it was probably about 50-50. Half of them carried on, half of them kind of left. I mean, I left to go to Australia. I mean, there's quite a few people who took F3s, essentially not because they couldn't get into their foundation, the further training program. But I think they just wanted a break, because if you're in the medical career path, they call it the treadmill. Once you're on it, you kind of just never get off. So the F3 is kind of viewed as this natural point where you can actually pause your training, take some time out, work as much or as little as you want. Because the other thing to mention is, I guess, Amber, you've got this to look forward to, which is F1 and F2 are actually really difficult years. They're probably like the worst years of your medical career in many ways, because you are essentially a walking clipboard and a needle.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
And, you know, obviously it's great because you get exposed to a huge amount, but it is really hard work. 50-hour weeks are kind of common. That's the average, essentially. So it's quite attractive to kind of have a year off where you're not as working as intensely. And I suppose the other thing to mention is lots of people who leave foundation training or complete it will then do something called locoming, which is essentially top-up work. So they'll pick up like overtime shifts. And those shifts tend to be pretty well paid. So, I mean, most of the time they'll start at something like £30 an hour, but often they can go as high as £60 an hour, depending on which hospital and which shift you're covering.
Okay. Mm. So I guess if 50% stick around, 50% leave, but it sounds like the majority of those still want to be doctors, just somewhere else.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And the pull is probably financial, and probably also you get to be in a nicer country than the UK, given that Australia and New Zealand are often the place that people go to.
So I'm not even sure if it's a nicer country so much as a generally more forgiving healthcare system.
Okay.
The financial kind of side of things can be one of it. I'm not sure about, I'm sure Rohan can talk about whether the pay generally is more lucrative in Australia than the UK. But from what I've heard, I know a couple of people who went to work in New Zealand, and it generally just seemed like your work-life balance was better. And because the system was less stretched, your day was less stressful because there wasn't as much risk placed upon you that would otherwise have been there with a kind of stretched and low resource healthcare system like the NHS.
Yeah. Was that your experience, Rohan?
Yeah, I guess financially salaries are better, probably depending on the region you're in. Realistically at 1.5 to almost 2. So it is a huge jump up. Mm. But also they tend to be much more expensive countries to live in. So living costs are substantially higher as well. I think it's interesting what you said, Dan, because the quality of life is a lot nicer. I don't know why, but they just seem to have more staff. Maybe it's because they have fewer patients, or maybe it's just because they have a higher density of doctors. But for instance, when I was working there, nurses were kind of not complaining, but just saying how lucky they were to only be looking after 4 to 6 patients on a ward. Whereas in the UK, it's not uncommon for them to be doing 10, 15, 20 at times. So it's a huge, huge change.
And vacancy is a huge issue with that in terms of nurses. Like, I was looking at the most recent statistics from the NHS vacancy, and I think in 2020, 2021, like that kind of region, their vacancy rate is about 10.5% across the NHS, which basically means that every nurse who's working has 10% more work to do every day, which really adds up in terms of work-life balance. And they're essentially not getting paid to do that extra work. But if they don't do that extra work, patients are put at risk. So it's kind of really preying on the good intentions of the healthcare staff, not wanting people to, you know, suffer, but also not really compensating them appropriately for the fact that the NHS is just working at this kind of 90% staffing at any one time.
And it's hard, right? Because in any other job, you can just kind of, if you're really fed up, you can kind of just, well, I suppose you can leave, but most people will kind of just say, well, I'll just do my normal hours and I'll leave at 5 o'clock. Whereas that's not really an option in healthcare because, unlike other jobs, people can literally die if you do that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more responsibility on us.
It's a real shame.
I suppose in terms of lifestyle, I think that's a good point, because when I was doing shifts as a doctor, that we had these terrible rotas, which we would work from 9 o'clock till 10 o'clock, 4 days a week, and then 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock the following. So essentially it was a 60, 65-hour week. Often you'd finish late on most days anyway. And then the next week, you'd end up doing a full weekend from Thursday till Sunday, 9 a.m. till 10 p.m. So that was pretty grueling.
Yeah.
But in Australia, when I got there, people were like, wow, I'm working half a day this Saturday. It's a really tough week for me. I didn't know if they were joking or not. So, you know, and when you're on call in Australia, they pay for your meals. I mean, it's only like $7 or something. But it's just a very nice touch. Often there'll be a canteen where you can just kind of go to with meals provided. If they're not, they'll kind of have vending machines where you can get food. So it's just a very different level and, you know, approach to medics.
Is it?
I think that's interesting as well. Sorry, Will. I was just going to say, I think it's interesting as well because from a patient safety perspective, it's really important that doctors, you know, eat and drink appropriately when they're taking care of people in order to maximize, you know, working efficiency and making sure that you're being safe. So like, I imagine, and I haven't done the maths, but it probably works out quite cost effective to make sure that your doctors are being fed at appropriate times of day in order to avoid mistakes. But on certainly like among nurses, even student nurses, before they even graduate, before they're even getting paid, their breaks are, you know, it's a real challenge to get your breaks protected and to be able to go away for lunch at a certain time. And people are really having to use a lot of resilience to put their foot down and say, actually, it's not safe for me to keep working like this. I need to go and take a break. But, you know, you can't leave patients unattended and it just ends up being an unsafe situation. So it's not even just a point of luxury to have your lunch paid for and your lunchtime protected. It's like a patient safety situation.
Yeah, absolutely. There was this, when I was in as a junior doctor, I was working out overnight and I remember this nurse panically calling me saying, this patient's not peed for, you know, 6 hours. And I was like, well, neither have I. Like,
what do you want me to do? It's when you look at the fluid balance chart and you think, oh, they've had this much to drink. Maybe I should have had something to drink today, anything at all, except just espresso. It's just funny.
So it sounds like Australia is the place where if doctors do leave the NHS, that's where they end up. Yeah. Is it a private or a sort of, what is the healthcare system there like? Is it very similar to the UK? Or?
It's dual tiered, actually. So what that means is essentially if you have the funds to go privately, then you can skip the queue. You can get slightly nicer drugs. You can get slightly nicer, like, you know, if you need a knee replacement, you'll get slightly higher quality knee prosthetic than otherwise. Okay. But otherwise, the state will then pick up if you can't afford it. So it's kind of like dual tier. So just, you also get to pick your consultant. So if you know, have a particular doctor that you really want to see, you won't just randomly get signed.
Okay. So it doesn't seem too dissimilar then, really. Because obviously the UK has private and there are sort of NHS doctors who also do private work, right? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's just the ratio of population who buy into the private system over the public system is kind of what varies between like these countries. Like,
yeah,
on the NHS is very, very widely used. And then there are a sect of people who also have private healthcare, but will probably still go to the NHS for some of their medical problems. And then you have the extreme in America where having health insurance is really, really key because they're like private sector is a much larger proportion of the healthcare available and the general hospitals are much more stretched for the population that you have. Yeah. So a lot more people go private for their healthcare out of necessity and also out of kind of it being the done thing.
Okay. Yeah. I'm cautious not to go too much into a discussion about whether or not healthcare should be private or publicly funded, but I just wanted to know to sort of understand why things seem to be better in Australia. So if 50-50, half stayed, half left. Was the sense that, and Amber will have an idea of this, is the idea that people know that they're going to leave? Or is it that F1 and F2 are so gruesome that by the end of it, they have to leave? Like, Amber, is there anyone in your cohort who's already said or is already thinking about stopping medicine or doing medicine somewhere else?
So I think there are people I know who want to work abroad, travel abroad, and incorporate their medical career into that already before they start their F1 and F2. They know that they're going to take an F3, perhaps even an F4, and that might be for travel and they won't work, or they'll do a combination of work and travel. And for some people, it's they want to do charity work and things like that, and that's something that's already a plan for them. Mm-hmm. I think one of the, so in my reading, one of the main reasons for leaving the NHS to go and do something else, whether that be within medicine or not, after F2 was burnout. So, right. And obviously you can't predict that you're going to be burnt out.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you can imagine that that's a possibility for you, but I don't think anyone goes into their F1 and F2 saying, I'm going to do this until I burn out and then leave the NHS. So I think for the majority of people who end up leaving the NHS, at least for a certain amount of time, it is as a result of being overworked and underappreciated generally in the things that contribute to burnout.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you say F1 and F2 are the hardest, because obviously if you come out of medical school and then you're hit with a really tough 2 years, that's naturally going to mean that you see less of the benefit from having been a doctor for a long time and sort of experienced all the good things that you manage, mm-hmm. and you just see all the tougher side of things.
It is disheartening, I think, as a concept, to know that you're just going to be battered, or that's the impression that people kind of give you, is that you're just going to be battered for 2 years before you actually start kind of reaping benefits from, you know, the 5 or 6 years of training that you've done. But I think, you know, from what I hear you, Rohan, was saying, I think it is better than it used to be. And there is an improving culture of respect for junior doctors, both among kind of from senior doctors and across the kind of healthcare team. Mm. And I think health literacy from COVID has done a lot for that as well, that people have a much better understanding of what doctors do and what the NHS is kind of looking like these days and what it's facing, because it's been in the news so much. I think that definitely has benefits. But over, like, I do think that from the F1s, for example, in my year, who've already graduated, and I took an extra year out, so I haven't yet graduated, speaking to them, it's hard work, but I don't think it's as hard work as it perhaps used to be because of human rights laws, essentially, and better contracts, and just a general understanding of the need to keep doctors around and treat them with a degree of decency.
Just on that note, I don't think I ever got my contract from Leicester Deanery, despite asking for it for a few times. So yeah. I'm sure it was a decent contract. I just never saw it.
Never read it. Yeah, I mean, I know lots of doctors who said I never signed a contract for my F1 and my F2. They were just paying me.
I never signed a contract either. So. Yeah. And I don't think any of my friends did. It's a very odd thing. I mean, it's
really strange.
It's remarkable.
I mean, the NHS doesn't have probationary periods as well. And the good thing, you know, we kind of, as medics and generally healthy professionals, we like to moan a little bit, I think. Like it's not all that bad. Like the pensions in particular is very, very good. But the one thing I think we kind of forget is the job security and how good that is. Like, you'll never be unemployed as a doctor unless you've really messed up and done something.
I think, to be fair, one thing I found interesting in my reading was that in the last couple of years, I think it was 2019 or 2020, I found a stat that said 91% of junior doctors leaving the NHS were not offered an exit interview. So although we can do lots of studies about why doctors are leaving, that it's, you know, often retrospective and it's from a particular cohort. For example, doctors who left to work abroad as doctors, that's like one study. Actually, en masse, and I think this is done more in nursing retention and in nursing people, nursing ending employment, exit interviews are a lot more common, and it's really key to understand why people are actually leaving. And their exit interviews are standard protocol in a lot of other huge organizations to be able to identify trends. But that just doesn't seem to be done as a kind of centralized process to understand why people are leaving the NHS overall, but also certain trusts. I think it's just really strange.
I guess also the other thing is, I mean, we talk a lot about money, but most people don't go into medicine for money. Like the vast majority of people just go into it because they like science and they like helping people, right? And then with burnout, I mean, from the sounds of it, actually, that my consultants used to often say that they used to work, you know, they were like, wow, you're only working 50 hours. We used to do 80 or 100 hours. Yeah. But from the sounds of it, their retention rates were much better then. So that almost brings in a cult. Yeah. You know, does that mean we're just kind of less resilient than we used to be?
I think it goes the other way. I think we're more resilient to be able to stand up to a toxic culture of you have to work yourself into an early grave in order to be upstanding and moral as a doctor. And so I think it's almost the junior doctors pushing back against that culture and actually saying, yes, I want to be a doctor. Yes, I want to help people. But that doesn't necessarily mean I have to sacrifice everything that I am and my entire life. Like, because a lot of people have vocational callings. Some people were meant to be lawyers and some people were meant to be electricians. But, you know, you don't ask electricians to work 80 or 90 hours a week without complaining just to prove that they were born to do this.
But it could also be that there wasn't a better alternative, right? It could be that Australia medical system is really good now, but wasn't always. Were you going to say something about that, Ryan?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because 20 years ago, it was pretty hard to move to Australia. I mean, the internet was just kind of kicking into gear.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, when I left in 2017, it didn't feel like a huge cultural upheaval. I had a bank account when I landed. I got a mobile phone within the first day. Like none of these difficult things that just weren't that tricky. Whereas I remember when my parents first moved to England, they had to write a letter from the Middle East to a hotel in London, like literally a letter to try and reserve a hotel. Like, it's just, so I suppose just the barriers of entry of moving countries.
Mm. And I guess also, you know, you're leaving so much more behind back then in comparison to now, when you can just still Skype your family every week and, you know, potentially even see them more than you would have if you were in the UK or something. Which is a good, you know, that's a good thing that people have that capacity to be able to move around nowadays. Though maybe not for the NHS.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's the benefit as well of a UK medical degree, is that it's quite easily transferable to populations sure. like New Zealand and Australia, where you don't have to take a lot of extra exams in order to practice in those countries. Whereas going, for example, I was speaking to a bunch of cardiothoracic surgeons last year in Bristol who were all from Italy. I don't know why. There was like 7 out of the 10 cardiothoracic surgeons working in that particular hospital were all Italian. And they were saying it's actually quite difficult to go and work in Italy from the UK because you have to have an Italian language qualification, take extra exams, et cetera, et cetera. But if you have a medical degree from certain countries, you can kind of work interchangeably between those countries, yeah. which makes it quite a lot easier to kind of move around from a practical perspective.
Yeah, that actually brings me on to something that I wanted to ask you guys about, which is obviously we've quite pessimistically introduced this as sort of a discussion around everyone leaving the NHS. But presumably there's also an influx of doctors, you know, from all over the place towards the NHS. Mm. I mean, you know, is that something which is going up or going down? Why do people come to the NHS if there are so many people trying to leave it?
It's going down. It's the old B word, unfortunately, Brexit to blame for it, a huge portion of it, which is we used to get a huge amount of healthcare professionals from other European countries, which has just completely been decimated. To the extent that actually people in the UK who've been working from Europe are now kind of being asked to go back, being forced to go back, essentially. Mm. So it's worsening the recruitment crisis. It's unusual for people to go from Australia, New Zealand to England. I think it does happen. Mm. There's big recruitment companies that kind of facilitate that, but it tends to be more the other way.
So I know quite a few doctors, and I think perhaps Birmingham is unique in that it's quite a metropolitan city. So there are a lot of people just in the general population who have a lot of family in the Middle East or from Pakistan or from India or from Bangladesh. So it's quite common for people to live, work interchangeably between those two countries in Birmingham. But I've seen a lot of doctors come who I talk to them, and they've come from India to work here, or they come from Pakistan to work here, or from the Middle East to work here in Birmingham. And I, as you say, I imagine it is going down because it's getting more challenging to do that. But the general reasons that I hear from them is that it's the specific quality of training that they wanted, or they were particularly interested in an area of surgery, and Birmingham is a hub for a lot of those things. And the attitudes towards healthcare in some countries rather than the UK are very different, and they didn't sit well with those doctors, so they decided to move to the UK for that reason. For example, in the Middle East, and this is just a few doctors' opinions as well, so I'm sure it differs across countries and cultures, there was a kind of a strange dissonance between the doctors having very much a kind of paternalistic knowledge of this is what you need, and a kind of consumeristic culture, especially because the healthcare system is very privatized there, of patients almost demanding
this is what I
certain
want.
Care, yeah, because they can pay for it. And I think if that doesn't sit well with you as a doctor because of your innate kind of reason to want to help people, that can be a reason to switch healthcare system because it just doesn't align with your values.
So I guess it's not just, you know, financial or lifestyle. I suppose there's a lure of a nicer, warmer climate. I suspect that's probably what
I mean, the Middle East and India have a much warmer, nicer climate than here.
Oh, so but I think that it must be the language which is making a huge difference, right? That will be why Australia and New Zealand are such hubs, because there are other places that will pay you more. There are other places that will be nice and warm, but, you know, they'll all come with other issues. Really,
culturally,
cultures are so similar.
It's close. Also, Australia and New Zealand, there's a massive recruitment drive, like constantly. Like, as soon as I signed up to, I think I Googled it once and it kept getting shown various ads from like recruitment companies, whereas I never really got that from other agencies in the Middle East, for instance. So,
I mean, so it sounds like your first couple of years being a doctor in the NHS is kind of a critical period. It sounds like there's either a switch in you where you say, you know, this isn't quite what I wanted it to be. I can do this somewhere else where I can be treated a lot better, or you sort of stick with it. But then, I mean, is there much dropout beyond that, or do people then stick with it? Is that the sense?
So I was looking at this recently, actually. I came across a stat that really surprised me, and it was in the last couple of years, 50% of doctor consultant positions are vacant at the moment. And that's out of the jobs advertised. And part of the reason was because no one applied to the jobs, and part of the reason is because there were no suitable candidates. And the suitable candidate side of things is they were talking about it kind of being a side effect of COVID, in that a lot of kind of senior junior doctors, so training doctors who hadn't quite reached consultancy level, had their training programs completely halted to deal with the COVID pandemic. And as a result, they're not qualified in the traditional way for the consultant positions that are available.
Okay.
And obviously then you have the other side of people not applying to them. And I think part of that also is because it's hard to be a consultant when 50% of consultants positions are unavailable, because it just means that there's more work for everybody else.
That's crazy though, 50%. Is that right?
Mm. Yeah, I was shocked. I was really, really shocked. But it was an article from the BMJ that says, you know, nearly half of advertised consultant physician posts were left unfilled.
Wow. Well, unless you guys have anything else you want to talk about, that's probably a pessimistic enough note to end on.
Yeah, I suppose just to summarize, it's not just, you know, it sounds like it's a multifactorial thing. Like it's,
yeah,
it's not just we get paid more, therefore we leave. It's very much I'm tired of working here, tried something else, natural career break, etc. I suppose what the most useful thing would be to actually do these exit interviews. I mean, actually, ironically, I got an exit interview when I left off my job.
Congratulations. Yeah. I mean, I think the important thing to note is that these things that are the kind of push and pull factors of people wanting to leave the NHS like people are becoming more aware of them, and the fact that they're entering the public eye in such a real way, especially in the last couple of years, is overall a good thing. And it's a catalyst for change. Like junior doctor contracts are getting better and are getting more merciful. And I certainly, from my cohort, we feel that we have more power in our hands to be able to stand up and say if we feel that we're being mistreated, and that again is a catalyst for change. So I just don't want anyone listening to the podcast to become really afraid,
be dissuaded, yeah,
going into a medical career because they think it's going to be absolutely awful. I'm sure that lots of people have a lovely time.
We can do another one about how amazing it is to be a doctor.
Yeah,
we've probably done that one to start with.
I think
you're right, Amber, that yes, always, it's difficult to change a large organization like the NHS, but it is possible. And, you know, like in my one of my first jobs as a doctor, it was absolute hell. But actually, by the time we left here, we kicked up so much of a fuss that it was fine for future generations of doctors. And ultimately, that's what every doctor's trying to do.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, it's fact time. Who wants to start?
Facts. Well, I can start with my fact.
Amber, you go first, but then I'll go next.
It's a bit of a U-turn, but I was reading about it and I just thought this was so interesting. So in professional badminton, the shuttlecocks that they use for professional badminton are made from 16 goose feathers, and all the goose feathers are from the left wing of a goose. And if they use the right wing of a goose, they spin the wrong way and the badminton players get very upset.
I'm astonished that they actually use goose. I would have thought
real geese, live geese,
like a synthetic.
So they have synthetic ones as well.
In case
the trajectory of a synthetic shuttlecock is very different to the trajectory of a goose feather shuttlecock. So I think at a very high level, they still use live geese shuttlecocks to the despair of a lot of animal rights kind of groups. But I guess also some people would argue it's considered a byproduct, so it's not as bad because it's the same geese that eventually reach our supermarkets and our tables. But
I'm not eating goose that often. I don't know.
Goose fat for the potatoes.
Yes, of course.
So I've just got this image now in like countries where badminton's endemic, that you've just got geese flying around with kind of left wings up and stripped there.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that they only use the left wings, because if you use the left wing feathers, the shuttlecock spins clockwise. And if you use the right wing feathers, they spin anti-clockwise, which kind of makes sense from a flight perspective for the goose, because otherwise if they had two sets of feathers that were both encouraging a clockwise direction, the goose would be flying in circles.
Yeah. But also, I guess, like, the fact that it's the right wing doesn't mean that that's wrong. It's just not what people are used to, right? Is that the idea? And so it's just the convention.
It's just not what the professional badminton players are used to. So I imagine there are right wing shuttlecocks out there, but they're not used at a very high level in badminton.
There's a spectrum of shuttlecock political dispositions now.
In Australia, everything's upside down.
Even stranger is that if you use a mix of feathers of the two, it doesn't spin at all. It just wobbles in the air and its trajectory changes again, which is why you have to use all one side or all the other. Because then you get a spin.
Well, right, so did you say you wanted to go next? It's a great fact.
It is a great fact. Yeah, I'm going to go next. So I'm in the pocket and can be absorbed by your amazing facts. Because I'm worried I may have said this already, but now I'll go again. Which is one of the things that annoys me in Hollywood films like Gravity is when individuals in space, when they kind of get exposed to the vacuum of space, seem to kind of turn into this like lollipop icicle very quickly. But people tend to forget that there's no particles in space, right? So essentially therefore, if they have no particles, there can't be any conduction. There can't be any convection. So the only mode of heat transfer, heat loss, is radiation, which is intrinsically extremely slow. And therefore, it would take days in order for you to lose enough heat to actually freeze to death. Normally you just kind of lose oxygen and die.
Yeah, I was going to say that will happen a lot quicker.
Yeah, that's my pet peeve. Yeah.
What's more as well is that, funnily enough, and I don't know why they wouldn't include this in Hollywood films, not only would you not freeze because of the lack of pressure outside your body, your blood and the liquids in your body would actually start to boil. There was a very interesting National Physics Laboratory lecture on it, I think. Because the difference in pressure inside your body, outside your body very quickly when you're exposed to the vacuum of space, the liquids inside you expand really quickly and your blood essentially would actually start to boil. Not because of increased heat, because of decreased pressure outside. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's just that, I think it's Charles's law, right? Like the concentration is proportional to the pressure outside.
Yes.
They don't include that, funnily enough, in gravity when people are exposed to the vacuum of space.
Well, also, the other thing about just adding on to the space thing is, you know, when you hear, I guess more sort of fighty sci-fi like Star Wars, all those explosions, you wouldn't actually hear, so it would, you'd sort of see it all, but it would be eerily silent if you're sort of watching another spaceship explode. Is that right?
Yeah, there would be very little sound conduction across the vacuum of space.
You would hear it if your ship was exploding, but you wouldn't hear theirs or anything
until you died, and then
you know, if a ship explodes in space but there's no one to hear it.
Did it actually explode then?
Did it? I think yes, but, you know, there's a whole discussion. Anyway, we can do that another time. What I'm going to tell you about is the fact that nuts spontaneously combust when in large amounts. So they've had, as a result, the shipping of nuts, obviously to different countries to sell, is a very exact science. The reason why they combust is they're very fatty, and the sort of process of sort of breaking down this fat is quite exothermic. So if there's a big bunch of them, they sort of all slowly heat up together until they reach a critical point and just start flaming away. So they have to have really temperature controlled, they have to have moisture controlled and oxygen controlled as well, because they've also... The process itself takes in oxygen and gives out carbon dioxide. So I couldn't find if anyone's actually been killed by it, but if they're kept in a sort of relatively concealed space and there are people sort of walking in and out of it, they could get suffocated by the nuts. So it's dangerous work.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I've just realized? What we should do is we should have one of these factors, like a complete fib, and see if we can...
That sounds ridiculous. I'm sorry. That's very backhanded.
I think that's a lie.
No, to be fair, Will, I have also heard this, that you can be suffocated by a large shipping container of nuts. But I couldn't remember what kind of nuts we're talking about.
Basically anything that's very oily. But lots of nuts. So pistachios, cashews, peanuts.
But presumably, if they're packaged, actually, then it's fine. It's just if they're open.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So once in supermarkets, nuts are safe. You know, your cupboards aren't going to start exploding. But it's when they're in those big sort of ships in massive containers, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder who discovered that the first
time. Well, a very upset.
Probably someone discovered it the hard way. Yeah.
And you know, realistically, the first time they discovered it, they probably assumed sabotage. So it probably happened again, at least a few times.
These saboteurs are amazing.
Why don't they want my cashew business to grow? Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you very much, Amber.
Thank you, Amber, our very first guest. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you both for having me. I've had a lovely, lovely time. And I've learned some new facts to take away with me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Take care, guys. Rohan, I'll see you in the next one.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Bye.